Pushing Faders in association with SVG Europe Audio.
Hello and welcome to Pushing Faders, the broadcast sound podcast. For the eagle-eyed amongst eagle-eyed, can you be eagle-eyed or eagle-eared because you're listening to it? It's not eagle-eyed, is it? Eagle-eared? That's not a thing, is it? That's not a thing. You know what I mean. For those of you who spotted it at the beginning of the jingle this week, there was a new part to it. So as of this episode and going forward, the podcast is now in association with SVG. It's great to have SVG on board with the podcast. I don't know whether that means I need to be a little bit more professional and not record the intros and outros of the podcast whilst I'm driving to and from work or even walking the dog. But in a little mashup of that, I'm currently driving Archie for a walk at Cawthorn Park. If you don't know where Cawthorn Park is, then don't worry about it, but it is the location of where the film Springtime on the Farm and Winter on the Farm, Autumn on the Farm, if that's one of them. But yeah. Various seasons on the farm. Anyway, moving on from that, because I was rambling a little bit, just a little bit more of an update. The podcast has now reached 5,000 listens, which is absolutely fantastic. I don't think when I say it every time when I get to these like little milestones in listens that it's a great thing, but I genuinely never thought I'd get to 5,000, so that's brilliant. So thank you very much for everybody who's listening. For those of you who listened to the last podcast, then you'll know that this episode is part two of my conversation with Rob Ashard. So I won't go too much of an introduction to it, but yeah, I hope you all enjoyed the first part of it, and I hope you enjoy the second part just as much. Along with the analog switch digital, what other bits of kit and technology have you started using in your LE shows that have made life better than it would have been 20 years ago?
Well, again, no question. Auto mix is right up there, especially. So when you mix light entertainment, you know, you're feeding a PA system. Quite often we've got floor speakers because there's a load of audience on the floor in front of the rake seating. And it's a big room. And so you've got the sound rattling around the room. Well, auto mix cleans it up. Incredibly, way better than you ever could. You know, the classic situation of the red chair on Norton, where you have four or five guests and then the band of three or four people come over. You can have eight or nine people on that sofa. And back in the... So before we had the Apollo at London Studios, we had a Carrick T-Series, which was digitally controlled analog. And that didn't have auto mix. So you just had to kind of push everything, pull everything down to kind of minus 10 and then go with it as much as you can. And to be honest, that worked. But this just, you can almost just leave everything parked with this and it just sorts it out. It is incredible. And it's twofold. The benefit's twofold. One is that we get a cleaner sound, and two is the audience get a louder PA.
Yeah.
But all at the same time. And this is all helped by having Cedar. So one of the first purchases I made as a freelancer was probably about 2005, I guess, was the Cedar DNS 1000, which was just the single two-channel, single unit two-channel device. And you just put that in the chat group. Now, back then, if you walked into a light entertainment studio, it sounded like an aircon plant because of all the fans in all the moving lights. And this thing was the next best thing to magic. You could show people when you switched it in and out, and it seemingly didn't affect how the voices sounded. But this noise just went. It was just, I still find Cedar amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, now you've got the 8 version, and I use those on all the personals and the fishpole on the red chair, for instance, on that show, and all the personals on Last Leg and whatever.
Channels into the Cedar.
Yeah, so there is a Cedar across every individual personal.
Yeah.
So all 8 are used. So I got 7 personals. So Graham and 6 six guests and the fish pole backstage, because it's very noisy backstage. And those, I my method of using them is I gang them all together. So I press button one and button eight and gang them all together. And then, because if you've got all your channel gains, you sort of, the first thing you do is with the chat show, of course, you never get to hear the guests until the evening. You still want your faders at around the zero point. Yeah. So your first things you're doing is trimming the gain. And then if someone's wearing a scarf over a mic, you'll brighten them up. But you need all the gains trimmed. But that means that all the thresholds should work on those mics. Now, interestingly, I think Richard put me onto this. I always used to have them, Richard Silito, I always used to have them pre-fade. But actually, Richard said, oh, I put them post. And I thought, okay. But of course, there were times if somebody turns off their mic or is suddenly gets very low and intimate, they fall below the threshold of the cedar and there's nothing you can do. And in fact, it makes it worse.
Yeah.
It makes it, because it takes all the top out off. It just makes a bad situation worse. At least if you have them post-fade, in the post-fade insertions, you can then, if someone turns off, if you can at least push them, or if they get quiet, you can push them, which will then open the cedar up. So it was a good shout from Richard. I hope he doesn't mind me sharing that gem, but it's something I've done ever since. And it's, do you know what? It's, we don't talk enough because we're all busy doing our own thing, but something like this is great. I think because we don't talk enough, all us.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I've feedback I've got from a lot of people is they're really into the like technical chat that the people have in, because I know some people obviously don't want to give all the secrets away, but there's,
well, I'm 64, I don't matter anymore.
I think people genuinely are interested in how people's workflows differ from other people's, and also, you know, I don't work on LE shows, so I'm interested in how they work compared to what I do. And I'm sure people who don't work on things I work on will be like, well, that's quite interesting as to how you guys work. So I do genuinely think that it has opened up the chance for people to sort of learn just how other people do things.
Yeah, I have to say I've always sort of been a bit of a sharer. I've done articles back in Studio Sound or Broadcast, whatever, I can't remember what it was now, about what I do. I'm now doing a little bit at Ravensbourne every now and then as well, just to certainly not for the money, just because I kind of want to put back. But I mean, it probably may be an interesting thing to talk about then is generally what I do on an LE show, just to give you a sort of a rundown of the path. So every personal channel has, I always start with a bit of EQ. So there's roll off at 100, 400. I have a couple of dB out, 3.5. I have a couple of dB in, and 10. I have a couple of. That's a very good starting point. There's no point in starting a personal flat. You will have to brighten it up.
Yeah.
So you may as well start with that, and you can actually on a reasonable normal person, you possibly won't feel the need to change it.
Do you have a preference of microphone for personals?
Sorry?
Do you have a preference of microphone head for the personals?
DPAs. I found we were doing a F-word with Gordon Ramsay. Actually, no audience on that. But we had a mixture of DPAs, and I think we got a white DPA. Well, the reason we'd done it is we got a white DPA for him to go on his white top. Mm. And then with everyone's mic set to kind of peak about the same, when I went through them, his seemed to have far less, it may be partly because he's quite loud, but it just seemed far less background noise on it. I've always just found I could get more PA out of the DPAs than the COS-11s. But COS-11s, funnily enough, we've just been using them on Fantasy Football for the pre-records. They're very good underclothing when you don't want, you know, when you're hiding them. For little skits that we do on there. So, that's where I'm with those. So, the channels, also have they'll have a 10-to-1 on them, set quite high threshold, so they only kick in if somebody laughs or gets animated. Most of the time, if you're just talking like I'm talking now, you won't be touching them.
Yeah.
Then they all go into a chat group, which is invariably group one, and that has a 3 or 4-to-1 chat compressor, and that does the bulk of the work.
Yeah.
But of course, if somebody shouts, the 10-to-1 in their channel stops you clobbering that chat group too hard. Yeah. So it sort of protects it in that way. Similarly, my audience mics, they've all got 10-to-1s in them that on laughs don't get hit, but on applause, which is much louder, probably take 5 dB off. But it takes off any loud spikes. It will hold someone whistling better, because someone whistling can then duck everything out if you're not careful. So that then goes into a that group goes into a fader, and that fader post fader out of that goes into usually a Neve 33609, just set on 6-to-1, and I think fairly fast attack and about 100 milliseconds decay time. And you push into that, and it means you've got my mic channels, audience mic channels, are set at 35 for a 460, current 460, not a current, AKG C460. Because back in the early days at London Weekend, they had 55 dBs of gain, and they all just square off. Yeah. Everything used to square. Everything got too loud, and I think the group squared off. I'm not quite sure where it happened, but it did. And I thought, no, let's. I want to clean this up a bit. So I pulled that all down. So I then put a bit of gain in that group.
Yeah.
To make that gain up. But it means that you can be quite cavalier with that fader. And it just makes little laughs louder because it pulls them up. But then it contains huge reaction all at the same time.
Yeah.
And I do now have on the... and the output of that fader then goes to a stereo fader, which is grouped to M1.
Yeah.
And also M2, because M2 is always my clean post-fader laugh output. And I do just have a bit of, whatever the desk is, some sort of dynamics in it, kind of 10-20-to-1, just to kind of hold it, just that last little bit. But that really is tickling. It's not doing much.
So
really, those two things combine on M1, but they've already had stages of compression, so they're quite managed at the point that they combine. And there's an M1 limiter. London Weekend, we used to actually have what we called a collector group, and those chat and post fade laughs used to go into that group, and we had a switchable Neve 33609. Russ Smithson still got one, and it actually is a nice... I half sometimes tempted to go back. When you have applause, you kick another compressor in, but you have to make sure that it's not happening. You're not kicking it in when it's already above the threshold, because you'll suddenly hear it come down. But what it does is it holds the applauses back by about 4 dB, and but my idea of putting the, not my idea, my method of putting the compressors in the individual mics has that effect a bit anyway. It holds the applause back a bit. And it just means, when everyone's coming in on Norton and they're all cheering like crazy, you can still hear him say, oh, come in, sit down, hello, da 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 da.
Yeah.
You can sort of hear that above that kind of mayhemic reaction. And I do personally think quite often in post, people hold that down. I think that if you've got a person talking and the 400, 500 people going nuts, they should only just win that battle. And it sounds, I think it sounds wrong if they don't. So sort of gets us onto my little post bugbear, is that they seem to be working. Loudness is a big thing for us. That hasn't worked for live entertainment. We really need a couple of laughs more allowance.
Yeah.
Because the laughs, the audience reaction uses up your loudness bank, if you like. So if Norton, I always give this, I've given this every time I've spoken about it, this example, but if you have whispering David Attenborough going into Graham Norton, David Attenborough's voice will be louder than Graham Norton's voice. And Graham's shouting at the top of his head, welcome to the show, because he can't be that loud because you still have to have that little bit in hand for big reaction. Yeah. And if you don't, the reaction sounds rubbish. And what I'm finding these days in post, that people in post are, they seem to take the minus 23 figure quite literally. So in chat, you can hear them pulling it all up. And then I've had situations where you've had this chat and then the band starts and they've got nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So the band sounds pants, absolutely so unimpressive it's not true, because they've allowed the chat to come up.
Yeah.
You can't. You need the chat to be at four and a halfs, five tops, whereas in the old days it was five and a halfs, you know, and then you'd let your band rip at six. Yeah. Well, I kind of still do that.
Has anybody ever been in trouble for not hitting it? I don't think it's ever happened, so... Forgetting the
what,
loudness.
For loudness?
Yeah, for loudness. Is anybody
loudness
knocking
discretions.
The door?
No, I've never been. I got one phone call once doing Dancing on Ice, but I think that was just a level thing. And our meters were all fine and we'd lined up. And Clemmy, lovely Clemmy, who I don't know if you know, sadly no longer with us, but used to guarantee. And he got rid of them with no uncertain terms, told them to go away because it was fine. And
I've had an MCR phone call once in the very early days of it, doing tennis, which, when I spoke to Lynn, you know, tennis is quite loud. It's not it's a very one or the other show. And I was apparently very low on my compliance for loves, and I sarcastically suggested to the MCR operator that I put tone out during the quiet bits
just to make it work.
Yeah, god.
Also, MCR seem to have a massive problem of making their continuity voiceovers or promo voiceover, not promos, but you know, the coming up next type things. They're all sorts of levels, but the right one, it seems. They're sometimes too quiet and lost under the thing they're talking over the back of, or they're ridiculously loud. It just seems quite extraordinary how they can't seem to manage to make a voice at the right level. Just extraordinary.
Yeah, intriguing.
Don't understand that.
So after your audience mics and the chat, what do we move on to there then? Is this where the band comes in, or...?
Yeah, so the band has... I always break the band up into four groups. So I have a drum group, a band minus drums, backing vocals and vocals. And I... there is a caveat with this, but I VCA every band mic, so that when I fade up a performance VCA that effectively fades up all the band mics together, but then they get stemmed out into those groups, if you like. So I can just have a little bit of compression on each, like the drum group and the band group, without the drums ducking the band, if you like. And again, I can just gently do the backing vocals and the vocals. I sort of like to have lots of little bits of compression in along the way, and it just helps you kind of manage it, really. Now, the downside of that idea is that if you forget to have that fader up when it should be, you don't have a pre-fade band mix
right
on your multi-track. So if you do that, you kind of have to say, oh, can I just play that one again? But it generally works very well. And, of course, you could then have more than one band on different VCAs, but then coming all into the same subgroups.
Yeah.
And controversially, I also feed the PA. So we don't have a PA mixer on Norton because it's a very formatted show. And I feed the PA off those four subgroups. Usually at minus five on the aux. Sometimes if there's a live like loud electric guitars, we turn it up another five off all the groups and makes it significantly louder. But there's a very good sort of broad spread PA, sort of, I think it's sort of six at the front, six at the back, or four, I can't remember which, but they're I think they're PS15s, is that that's next though, isn't it? And they go very, what's the French make PA? Really good. L'Acoustic. Are they French? They always sound French. Anyway, I think it's either them or big PS15s. Can't remember which now. But it goes very loud and it's very smooth across the whole area. And then we have two rows of six 460s hanging down for the audience. So there's 12 audience mics on that. I think we've got even more on last leg because there's 15 on last leg because there's another three behind. If you remember, there's a bit of audience behind behind them. So we have 15 on that. So I actually, every desk I use in TC1 is a daughter of the Norton desk because once you've set out, got the gains and the structure all right, you then and then actually what I tend to do is I'll use the desk that has the most similar attributes, but they've all come from the Norton desk basically.
Do you find your workflow changes much between having to use a Studer and the Calrec?
Not at all. No, I would advocate trying to do very similar. I even use AUX 3 as fallback left, just so you're in familiar territory. Yeah, you don't have to think too much then.
I've kind of built desks the same way where every AUX is sort of what it was 15 years
has
ago.
Has its function.
Yeah.
It just makes it less for the brain to do. It makes you more muscle memory type thing, when you're dealing with something quickly. You don't have to think about it. You know it's going to be that AUX. So, I would advocate trying to do that. And my signal path is the same. It works for me. Going back, incidentally, that whole thing about a lot of people that have possibly come from music and sit down at one of these desks and they have a bunch of personals, when they've used a music desk, they put that compression in every channel. Well, and of course, when you've got background noise and PA spill and back in the day, fans and lights and whatever, the amount of gain reduction that you would have in each of those mics, when you have that in your chat group, it effectively then ducks all the other mics. So I'm sort of carrying on principles I did in my analog days into my digital days, although you could argue that with the auto mix and stuff, it's not as relevant. But I just sort of stick with it because it's sort of what I know. But that's how I came about doing that. It was much cleaner to have everybody on one group and then that chat group compressor effectively ducks everyone out.
Yeah.
And if you still have the individual compression limiter, it then still stopped them ducking anyone out particularly hard. But that's how that came about.
It's interesting for workflow like that because I think because I didn't really have any formal training from how to mix until much later after I'd been mixing for like 6 years. I never really thought about how stuff works like that. Like it was a setting on the desk and I just stuck with it. So obviously getting more experience, I was like, if we tweak a little bit, it makes this difference. And, because back doing music tech, you learn the theory of how a compressor works. You learn the theory of how, EQs work, but you never really use them properly until, you're much further down your career, I think.
Yes. You can't beat doing it to learn. But I mean,
I think it's getting the confidence once you've done it for a while, you get the confidence to then play around. Whereas before, you'd probably be like, well, this is how this person who I've sat on the desk afterwards, they're doing it like this, so I'm going to keep it like this. And then you sort of think, oh, I might just tweak it a little bit, once you're further down your career, a bit more confident.
The thing is, we don't have much playing around time. That's one of our big troubles.
Yeah.
So here's a good example. On a band, I tend to have all the bottom rolled out of my overheads and use the tom mics for the toms, whereas, some people sort of argue that it's the toms with a mixture of the overheads. Well, first of all, you can have, because of the distance, you can have a phase discrepancy where sometimes reversing the phase on the overheads can make it sound better. Mm. We don't, but that's what you do in a recording studio when you spend a week on the drums. We've got to get, we get a mix going in 20 minutes from scratch, you know, so I know that doing what I do kind of gives me the control I need quickly.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, you know, it's possibly, you know, you, it might not be the best way, but it's the way that kind of works in the context that I'm working in, which is usually, not a huge amount of time, really.
Do you have any favourite moments from Norton?
Well, I think I've sort of mentioned them, really. The Neil Diamond one was right up there. Mm. I mean, there's just been some hilarious, absolutely hilarious interviews.
Yeah.
You know, and you get proper A-list. I mean, Tom Cruise has been on there three or four times.
Yeah.
Matt Damon famously said, you know, this is the most fun I've ever had on a chat show. And I actually have had a sneaky listen to people and they're buzzing.
Yeah.
Absolutely buzzing when they come. They love it. They clearly enjoy it. It's interesting with the American guests. I'm not saying anything you can't see at home. But sometimes a sort of surprise, because America's quite prim and proper in a funny sort of way.
Yeah.
So they're sort of quite surprised to hear people swearing.
Yeah, I think I've seen a couple of Americans where they've sort of questioned whether they're allowed to swear after hearing it, and then felt the need just to swear to make
Yeah, I won't say what Graham Runt replied. It was very, very funny. They kept it in but bleeped it, but it just got the biggest laugh ever. He said, you can say bleep if you like, and it was the worst word. It was just hilarious. Graham can pull off, because of his lovely, happy smile, he can be quite shocking.
Yeah.
But he's so good. You know, anyone who's come and seen it, he's brilliant with the audience before they start. He's a brilliant interviewer. The research is second to none. Mm.
I think it's nice. Obviously, they obviously have a couple of drinks in them as well to loosen them up before they go off. They don't, yeah, they probably don't do in America. That.
Yes, I think that's happened, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think that happens in the American chat show. So they're probably a little bit freer with what they're about to say because of the couple of drinks in them.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously can be a good recipe for a good interview. I'm very lucky. I think it's a fabulous show. I still think it is. It's entertaining to watch. I still watch them. You know, I do tend to watch back a lot of the stuff I do, even if I scoot through it. Sometimes things you worry about when you listen back, you think, because when you've got your hands on the faders, you know that something may be a bit further down than you'd wanted it, and you kind of correct it.
Mm.
But actually, when you don't, when you're not there reliving it, you don't hear it.
Mm.
So things you do worry about sometimes are actually fine, and then other things you go, oh, crumbs.
Yeah.
So you never stop learning, I don't think. It's worth kind of keeping an ear on things you do.
I had one the other night where it was bugging me, but it was, we'd had a text from somebody at home saying one of the guests' mics got a lot of high-pitched buzzing on it.
Oh, but crumbs.
I couldn't hear it because of the fan noise and all, you know, the various other bits of kit behind. So then I ended up having to, like, piffle it and crank it up full to have a listen. I was like, oh, yeah, it's the LED lighting that's causing that. But we obviously repaired it, but because it bugged me then, because I was like, can't hear it because of all the noise behind you.
I know, not ideal at times, particularly in trucks. It's always a bad thing. I know some of the trucks I've been in, they put some sort of Perspex screens bolted to the front of the racks to sort of deflect it, stood off to let air and stuff in. But
a lot of trucks abroad tend to have more of a thought into them about where the noisy bits of kit are. I mean, I've been in a truck that was it a Dutch one? I think it was at NEP or EMG Holland, and literally in sound there was a desk, some speakers, and some computer screens. Where the other bits were, I don't know.
Okay, a machine room somewhere. By the sound of it.
It was amazing, and it was pretty new. So everything was it had no analog in it. Everything was fiber.
Right.
So they could hit recall on the desk and recall on the Riedel and put the fiber boxes out in the field, and it was, there you go, done. They could rig a football ground in like minutes, where it takes like, well, yeah, and that couple of hours, and it might take us all day or whatever. But yeah, it was such a nice truck to work in. And on the rig day, you could lift the desk up so you could stand up and build your config.
Oh, crumbs.
So it was a nice little standing desk. You couldn't mix like that because it blocked the monitors, but while you were sort of prepping and everything, you could stand up, which is quite nice.
One nice little story, probably worth finishing with, the thing of having fibres or Cat 5s with all your audio on it is a bit scary because you've got a lot of eggs in one basket. And when I was doing I'm a Celeb, we transitioned from analogue to digital. And I think we used Opticore was the system that we used. And the first year we did it, we get a lot of lightning strikes there and quite extreme weather at times. And so I was thinking, oh, crumbs, this a lightning strike could take all this digital stuff out, couldn't it? So the first year we sort of ran the two. We had splitters and everything came up to us in two. So an analog and a digital feed, basically. And we used the analog for the first year really to sort of assess how reliable the digital one was. Yeah. And one morning we came in, there'd been this terrible thunderstorm overnight. And of course, all these analog feeds are from multitracks spread all over the camp and multi-way, long cables anyway, all coming in with all these mics on them. Everything plugged into the analog stuff was completely trashed.
Yeah.
All the digital stuff, because they were all sort of short runs.
Yeah.
We're all fine.
Yeah.
So from that moment onwards, for the following year, we took the digital side as the master side, and having checked the analog side, we then unplugged all the multiways.
Yeah.
And then if it all fell over, yes, we'd have to plug them back in, but at least they'd work.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an interesting thing. You know, we were so scared of the digital seemed so frail back in the day, but actually, in certain ways, it isn't. But yeah, you do lose a lot if something fails.
It is the eggs in one basket analogy. It just sums it up completely, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But at least you've got usually a redundant, you know, with the fibres and Ethernet cables, you've usually got a main and a backup.
Mm.
I mean, Dante's been a fascinating thing. I've got a little system we haven't used for a while now, based around an Allen Heath SQ5, which is a little 16+1 fader digital desk. And again, I've done jobs with that I've mimicked the whole routing thing, and I've done PA off it, I've multi-tracked off it with Dante. You know, you've got this tiny little network when you've got your laptops hanging off it, and it fed a ferrofish, which broke things out to analog as well. And one day someone did a job with a video company, and they said, oh, can you give me optical? And the ferrofish gave optical out as well as Dante, and I just gave them that. And, you know, so sometimes the digital world is just fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Just finally then, because it's something that I watch religiously, obviously you do Taskmaster as another project you work on. What's that like as a... I'm probably more just wanting stories from behind the scenes rather than technical knowledge behind it.
Well, it's a delight. I'm here to tell you that everybody is so nice, the directors and producers, and everybody is lovely, and it's just a joy to work on. Alex is one of the nicest people in telly, Alex Horn. And just, well, you know, always says hello and how are you and all that sort of stuff. And they just sort of seem to appreciate what you do. It's hilarious. I mean, I've had tears running down my cheeks watching that and mixing that. Needless to say, there are moments that are unbroadcastable that tend to be very, very funny. But no, it's great. It's very clever.
Yeah.
I think it's a clever format. It's just a joy to do. So yeah, we're very lucky to have that one. We've done that pretty much from the beginning.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, cause it's
great. It's good fun. We do that, by the way, at Pinewood. So that's on a Artemis at Pinewood. It's good fun. It's one of our favourite shows.
Compared to something like Norton, it must seem a bit more relaxed, right? Because there's no bands and there's not, you know, it's...
Yes, it is. I mean, the Norton is, you know, very sort of formatted. We all know what we're doing, but the band element does can be stressful, no question. But it is very nicely relaxed because it's fairly straight. You're just mixing people and then playing some VTs. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's quite simple in that respect. But, yeah, I think it's very funny and it's very clever. Norton I hold in high esteem, think I'm very lucky that we've got it. Taskmaster 2, Last Leg has been great, you know, that we've been doing that for 10 years. That has a great atmosphere. The audience is usually always very good and kind of quite a partisan crowd. And those have been long-standing ones that have been good. All the way through, and we're very grateful to still have them.
Yeah. You mentioned something during COVID where you would stream it to a cinema for the audience.
Yes. COVID gave us some very interesting situations. So we did one series where there was no audience, but we used the control room at TC1, but the presenters were just at home. So Alex and Josh were in England, they all had a live view camera, but of course live view has a bit of a, is it half second latency, something like that?
Yeah, I think
maybe
yeah,
not quite. Yeah. It's significant.
Yeah.
And Adam was in Australia, so Tim Wood, who is the technical manager in TC1, came up with this. I'm jealous that I didn't come up with it, but he came up with it. So we had TBUs at each location. And they were all fed each other. So the TBUs came into me, and so I had mixed minuses back to the TBUs so they could all hear each other. But we had their cameras coming in with the same mic coming down the camera, but delayed. So each of their mics was actually a VCA, a DCA, and the DCA, so Adam's DCA faded up his TBU and his live view camera. So his TBU fed the mix minus for their chat, and the live view fed the chat group.
Yeah.
And so it meant that they had a real-time conversation on the phone, and we all saw it and heard it half a second later, basically.
Yeah.
So with comedy, it was quite essential, really. Funny thing was, is we, good for them, they gave us a practice week, and we got two Zoom calls, usually most weeks, and I'd fed the Zoom call off the TBU side of it, but actually because the real chat was later, it's amazing how accurate the human ear perceives time it correctly or incorrectly, and the answers were fractionally ahead,
right?
Because I'd fed them off the off the TBU side, and I very quickly realised what the situation was and reconfigured. Yeah. It was an easy reconfigure, that was interesting. And also, I did Norton, and I did Takeaway, and where we had virtual audiences, and that was again interesting. Takeaway particularly because we had a little bit of Graham's help with some of the audiences, just because they didn't necessarily stop when we wanted them to, so we would sort of have an applause going that ended. And we just made it sound more natural. But actually, everyone you heard in that screen was part of the audience you heard, 100%. Yeah. That came in on, I think, sort of three groups. There was a whole bunch of people managing that side, and they were monitoring. I think they had three sort of people monitoring across. So if someone had a barking dog, they would find them and mute them and all that sort of stuff. No, it worked really well. One of the things I did on that was to have the PA running in the audience in the studio, even though there was no audience. So we had PA spill on the mics, made it sound like a live event.
Yeah.
I think it also helped the energy in the room because they could hear their own voices rattling around. I put some of that audience from the computer from the virtual audience back in. By virtual, I mean they were real people. We just called them a virtual, but they were all people on computers. So some of that came back into the room so they could feel. I think it's weird being a comedian and not hearing some reaction back. Yeah. So they had that. It also just helped to kind of fudge the sound, because the trouble with that is you had that sort of MP3 quality. So we also had a hand, anyone spare, went into the studio next door and reacted to the show.
Yeah.
And so that applause also helped cover up the kind of MP3-ness of what was coming in.
Mm.
So it sort of evolved over about 3 weeks, but I was, funny enough, it's one of the things I'm probably most proud of as to how it went, because it was really different. You know, no one had ever really had to kind of do it, and we kind of made it work. I think it worked really well. And I don't think your average viewer would have kind of thought, oh, this is weird.
You know,
it just felt like a Saturday night show. So, yeah that was an interesting... COVID was weird, wasn't it, for everybody?
Yeah.
But I'm sort of glad that we had a couple of really interesting technical things to combat it. So, interesting times.
So I listened to the Taskmaster podcast, and Victoria Curran was talking about how she felt all of her prize task, like, jokes she tried to make failed because there was no audience there to react to it. So she tried to make, like, clever rather than sort of being daft with her prize tasks, she tried to be clever and, like, play on words for all of them. And she said in the podcast that because there was no audience in there, it felt like all of her things were just falling flat, because there was no, because obviously Greg's job is to look at her like, what are you talking about? So that's the reaction she got.
Yes.
It was just him, rather than like an audience like laughing about her little play on words she'd made, and said that, because I think you redubbed it.
Yeah, so we went to a nice little cinema in called the Curzon in Shaftesbury Avenue, and they had a showing there. And each little unit was spaced by a seat or two.
Hmm.
But we still had, probably about 80 people in there, and used that system that my Alan Heath set up, did the playback off a kind of hard drive video recorder, and obviously recorded that sound onto the program and mixed in the audio, but multi-tracked it all so they could unpick it as well. But it actually, it worked really well. So interesting times those. Glad we probably won't come back to them, but we learned a lot on the way.
Yeah, I mean, it sped up in this country, especially like remote production just had to speed up massively compared to what it was. It obviously pushed things ahead and made a lot of difference with some stuff. But yeah, thank you very much for spending the time chatting with me today.
No worries, enjoyed it. And as I say, I like the concept of the chat that everybody gets to hear all this rubbish.
Thank you. I do ask one, because I have two questions. There's either, if you've worked on the road, it's your favourite services, but obviously you spent a lot of studio time. So it's, what is your favourite bit of, or most important bit of non-sound related equipment that you carry around?
Crumbs. Sharpies.
Sharpies, oh, fair enough. I'd still say that was sound equipment, to be honest.
Sharpies and white plant. Yeah. I like white PVC tape to write on.
Yeah.
I think it feels nice. So, Sharpies and PVC tape. That's all I can think of, really.
Yeah, mine's my coffee equipment. But it's thrown a couple of people, because then they've sort of thought about it and thought, I'm so sad, I can't think of anything.
But anyway, I've enjoyed doing this, but I've enjoyed my life in telly, I have to say. I feel I've been lucky and thoroughly enjoyed it, and I really wouldn't change it. I just feel very lucky. If you enjoy your work, you're so ahead of the curve.
I think, for the most part, I have. A couple of people described it as they've not worked a day in their lives, really, after spending all the years working to you, which is quite a nice way to end something when you think about it like that. That it's a hard, you're doing long days, you're doing difficult stuff, but at the end of the day, if you enjoy it, it takes the edge off it.
Yes, absolutely. And also, what a lot of nice people that I've worked with for a long time. And as I say, lovely to work with Lee Smith the other day. We were trainees at the same time.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for joining me.
No worries. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah. Hope it's okay.
Big thank you to Rob for taking the time out to speak to me on the podcast. As I said, we did chat for quite a long time, so it was nice to be able to split it into two episodes rather than losing a lot of the information, because it was really good of Rob to talk through his workflow and how he goes about compression and EQ on these things. So I hope there's been a lot of information there for people who might not have worked in light entertainment very often and found it useful, or for people just interested in how other people go about their workflows. Always good to sort of share information there. Joining me on the next episode of the podcast is Glenn Stillwell. Now, Glenn's actually my first international guest. He joined me from America. He got up quite early in the morning to have a conversation with me, and he's a Dolby Atmos trainer from the United States. So hope you all tune into that in a couple of weeks' time. And until then, we'll see you later.